Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA at pnwa.org, pnwa.org. Well, not much happening in the world of Bill and his teaching and talking. It's December. I'm going to be going out to Washington, D.C. to watch my son graduate from college. I cannot believe it. I cannot believe it how time goes by. But that's what I'm going to be doing right around Christmas time. But then I'll be back and we'll do more shows. But in the meantime, we've got a show today with the wonderful Alex Dolan. And Alex is a suspense author. He's the author of two books so far, although I'm sure many more to come. First book was The Euthanist, and followed up just recently with The Empress, of Tempera. He is also the host of Thrill Seekers, which is part of the Authors on Air Global Radio Network, a fine little group that is. He was an executive committee member of the San Francisco Bay Area's Lit Quake Festival, and is a member of the International Thriller Writers and Sisters of Crime. If you're a thriller writer, I highly recommend joining International Thriller Writers. They're awesome. He has also recorded four music albums and created the End of the World Festivals, which combine philanthropy with the arts. What a busy guy, and he's here. He's made time from his busy schedule to be with us. Alex, welcome to the show.
Bill, thanks for having me.
So, Alex, you've got books out. You're a novelist now. You've done a lot of stuff, but now you've put on your novelist hat. Why? How did this happen?
I grew up with around books. My dad was in publishing, so my parents are both painters. So I kind of got the creative bug pretty early, and I grew up around that. And then, starting around five, I just started writing my own stuff because my dad worked for Houghton Mifflin, and I just grew up around books. And when I was really young, he took my first real story, which was, you know, handwritten, and he ended up typesetting it and binding it. And this was, you know, back in the days where you had to do all this stuff by hand. And it was very labor-intensive, but, you know, it wasn't a very long book. But it was still, you know, he made the effort to do it. And it was awesome. And, you know, I got this, the taste of it really early on. And it just was something I always wanted to do. I always wanted to kind of be a voice to tell stories.
Wow. And so that's interesting. Your parents were both painters, you said, and your dad worked in publishing. So, and I'll tell you, I've interviewed hundreds of writers, obviously, over all the last 10 years or so. And traditionally, writers don't know – most writers I've talked to did not grow up around other artists. It's pretty rare, you know, like a lot of actors and such that I've – a lot of the artists I know didn't grow up around artists. But you grew up not with – were they writers also or mostly in publishing and painting? Was painting the main artistic discipline that your parents pursued?
Well, for them, yeah. But they ended up training us, you know, I always kind of joke that we were like little geishas because they trained us on every art form they could possibly teach us. So we were exposed to music and the visual arts and writing and pretty much anything that was a creative outlet we kind of knew a little bit about. And then, you know, my brother, sister, and I all gravitated toward different things. I was a musician for a long time. But it was all – it wasn't like it was visual arts or nothing. It was – we really got a taste of all of it.
You know, but that's – it's really cool, and it's different because – one of the hurdles I think a lot of writers have to overcome, which is true of all artists, but I'm talking to writers mostly here now, is the idea of the arts as a legitimate pursuit, as being as real as teaching or the law or medicine or whatever. Because it can seem so – I think so often artists are portrayed as, I don't know, different and out of the mainstream and not – not something, the arts not being something that just anybody can pursue. But it would seem to me that growing up around it, that maybe that broke down some of the mystique that gets laid on the arts. Was that true, or did it still carry that for you?
I think, I mean, that's a really good point, and I think there are a couple of factors. I think for me personally, growing up wanting to be an artist in a family of artists was actually not, wasn't the most supported thing in the world, because my, especially my father, came from a line of lawyers, and he was lawyers and engineers, and he was essentially the black sheep, and, you know, deviated from that traditional profession. And then, you know, when I, when he knew that I wanted to go in that direction in my early 20s, I got, you know, they would clip out articles that they would read in the Boston Globe about how it was impossible to make money as a musician and stuff like that. And they would forward me these not subtle hints about wanting to steer me back on kind of a mainstream path. And I think what happened for me was this course of proving myself of that I was basically, I was passionate about it, but I also kind of was competent in terms of at least knowing, you know, how to do what I wanted to do. And
right.
I think that, that earned enough respect where they realized this wasn't just a fleeting whim.
Right.
But I also feel like, you know, between, say, our generation and the, you know, my niece and nephew, and other kids that are growing up now, what I hear from them is there's such a vast array of professions that where you can be successful on your own terms that didn't exist when we were growing up. And, you know, I remember, like, do you remember the Game of Life, that, like, horrible board game?
Yes, I certainly do.
And, you know, like, you know, and you were really bummed out if you got to, you had to be the teacher.
Yes.
And, but the professions that were really the cherry professions were like a doctor or a lawyer. And there were like five professions you can get. And those, I remember growing up, I was like, that when you thought about success, I and a lot of friends of mine thought of success in terms of just a handful of very mainstream traditional professions. And now, like, for a time, my nephew wanted to be cake boss. And because you could be a millionaire pastry chef, and you can be a millionaire personal trainer, and if you provide enough creativity and intelligence to a profession, you can really define your own success. And I think that has changed in the last few
decades.
In terms of how it applies,
I was going to say, I think about growing up, if there had been YouTube and computers that I could edit my videos, that I could shoot on my phone, I would have been making that stuff all the time. My brother and I were doing theater. We would put on shows, but really the stuff we were writing wanted to be filmed, but it was so expensive and cumbersome to make anything if you didn't have all the equipment. Now, my God, it's so easy. So easy by comparison.
Yeah, the means of production are in our hands, and they're a couple hundred bucks.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah.
You know, I have a theory about money and the arts and careers and success, and I think one of the big differences between the arts, finding any kind of success, how you define that, although how you define success varies from person to person to person, so it's not like it's a finish line that everybody's trying to cross, but I think the big difference is that there are careers like law, for instance, and medicine, where you can make a lot of money, have a lot of prestige, and not really like what you're doing. Not really. Kind of like it, but not love it, but not love it, but still be making six figures or whatever. That is not true of the arts. You cannot, in my experience, and I've known so many artists, have any success unless you simply love doing it, whether you were paid or not. And that is not true of bartenders and waiters and probably teachers, but many, many professions, they wouldn't do it probably if they weren't getting paid. Or at least you can have a life, even though you don't love it. You cannot in the arts. You just can't, I don't think. What do you think?
I think that's probably true. And I think that it goes hand in hand with getting really good at something. I think there are other professions that you can, with enough training, and I think this is true of medicine too and law, that if you go through the programs and you have the right amount of training, you'll get a degree and you'll be able to practice that profession. Yeah. And there's some doctors and lawyers that take that and over time can acquire wisdom and judgment and be able to take that toolbox and do great things with it. And I've certainly seen examples of people who have that training and that's it. And they're not great lawyers, not great doctors. But I think with the arts, you're developing this craft, and the only way to be successful is to be really good at it. It's like being an athlete. And the only way to be really good at it is to love it enough to do it all the time. And
that's right.
So, I mean, I think to your point, I think, you know, you need passion because you can't half-ass it. You really have to want to do it enough so that you become good over time.
Yeah. And to that, on that note, I'm curious. So you made music. You were loving that. I assume you liked making the music. But now, sometime recently, you decided, no, I'm going to go back to fiction writing. Had you been writing fiction all that time, or had you put down the pen for a while to pursue your music career?
I had tried to juggle both. Throughout my 20s, I've been trying to juggle both. And I had got to a point where I had people that were shopping me around for a music deal, and I had that
right.
going on, and then I had a book that got picked up by an agency, and they were shopping that around, and I thought everything was about to break open for me, and it didn't, and it was that book at the time, it shouldn't have been acquired, it shouldn't have been published, it wasn't ready yet. And I realized that I was okay at doing both, but not great at doing either. And so it was a really calculated decision for me to want to really go as deeply as possible into one craft. And so it was very painful because I'd loved music for so long, but I ended up throwing all of my time into writing and trying to learn everything I could about it and just and focus on that. So that's what happened. I chose that one direction.
Take me back to that moment. When you look at the two, because I've recently, within the last 10 years, taken up music more seriously for writing it. Love it, love it, love it. It's been a great second, but more not a hobby, not really a career yet, but I love it. And so they're very different, but they have their similarities, obviously. But take me back to that moment, because you're doing both, trying both professionally, and you have to make the choice. What was it about the writing that drew you to it as opposed to the music?
I think that the difference between music and writing for me, and I hope those sirens aren't for you.
They're just my windows near the street. Everything is fine here, I think. Thank you for asking.
They hear officers crashing through the door any moment.
Yeah, that's right.
So the difference was that I have a huge satisfaction in creating something that was tangible, whether it was a recording or
right.
a piece of writing, and be able to just kind of put my name on it and just kind of point to something that I produced. And I was very, I'm happy to do that in a lot of mediums. But that's kind of where the similarity ended. Music is a lot more collaborative.
Yeah.
Not that you don't collaborate with editors to some degree as a writer, but you have less control over the creative process, or I did. It was more about the performance and seeing it live, and that was exciting and also sometimes frustrating because you're managing different personalities, and it's less creative control ultimately. And with writing, I had more of a chance to control that process from the beginning. And I liked
right.
that. And I also felt like, you know, in terms of me having a viable career as a writer, there's a lot more longevity in being a writer than a musician in the way that the current music industry is
right.
set up.
And Alex, do you like being alone? That seems like another requirement for most writers. Do you enjoy your privacy?
I mean, I do like downtime. I actually write in public most of the time.
Ah, well, you're one of those.
Because I'm one of those, and I think it just comes out of being a broke musician in my 20s and going to cafes because I wanted to get out of my apartment, and I'm just used to being around people when I do it. And so it's a lot more natural for me to kind of be in a public space where there's a little bit of a hum of people than staring at a wall at my house.
Interesting.
I can do it, but it doesn't come to me as easily.
All right, you got to know how you work. Everyone works differently, and does it ever happen? So I'm one of those who needs a blank wall. Although I have written in cafes now that I think about it, but mostly it's at a blank wall. Do you ever find when you're writing in public that anything in that public sphere insinuates itself into your work, or are you just blocking? Is it really just white noise?
I think when I was younger, it did, and I sometimes would. I'd sort of like Kaiser Soze in my room, and whatever was on the wall would, if I was caught stuck somewhere, I'd look at somebody and something about them would leak into the work. But I don't think I do that so much now. I think it's really just the energy of activity and the kind of the vibrance of being with other people is a lot more energizing for me than being in a room by myself.
It reminds me of it. It's sort of like, you know how it is. If you were a performer, an artist, musician, there is that thing that happens when you're in front of people. It's just not so much the attention, just the energy in the room that brings a piece to life. And I wonder if there's a little bit of that going on with you when you write, just the human energy around you that you can sort of draw off of.
There might be. And there definitely, that is something that's very different about music. There's something that's really great about connecting with people at that level when the piece, the thing that you're creating is happening in the moment. And you don't get that when you're doing readings. I mean, it's a different kind of connection. And I have the most fun when I do readings during the Q&A, when people can just talk to me and just, we just have a normal conversation, unless when I'm reading words on a page to them.
Yeah, it's interesting because there is a connection that happens between the writer and reader, but the two parties aren't together. It happens through the book, and it's quite magical in terms of I don't know if you've gone through this because you have two books out, and I'm sure you've spoken to a number of your readers. My experience of when people talk to me about the stuff of mine I've written that they've read is that what they've read and what I wrote never feel exactly the same. So somehow it transforms in them. I don't know if you've had that experience, but it happens to me every time, whether they liked it, even if they didn't. But particularly I notice it when they do like it. Have you gone through that at all?
I totally go through that, and I think that's one of the things that's very magical about it, is that you put this seed of a story in someone's head, and that's part of what you do. It's almost like I'm sure screenwriters would be able to relate to this even more, where if you ever read a screenplay, it's a very bare bones thing. The world isn't created until it gets interpreted by the director. And I feel like in a way, like everyone who reads a book is their kind of their own director, and you're creating, you're enhancing the world that we've written. A way that really came to life for me for the first book, the Euthanist, was doing the audiobook, where I was lucky enough to work with an actor who narrated the book, and she did a very in-depth read of the book, and we talked about different motivations. We kind of really dug into the characters, but then she just kind of did her own thing, and I intentionally laid back and let her have total creative control, because at that point it's a different experience anyway.
Yep.
Even that version of the book
is different. In fact, when I teach writing class, I teach memoir. The way I do it when we workshop what they call workshop pieces, the students give me their work and I read the work aloud to the students. And the reason I do that is, and these are often, a lot of them haven't published stuff, some have, but a lot of them haven't, is I want them to hear their work in someone else's voice, to know that whoever reads it is not going to be they're going to experience it different, or they're going to read it differently than the writer read it in their mind as they were writing it. They're going to put emphasis on different words, so it helps them hear someone else translate it, because that's the experience. And it's you give your work away to the reader in a way that it's hard to understand until you experience it. You really give it to them.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the fun of it. I mean, I think
yeah,
I don't.
It is.
I'm not terribly protective about it.
Good.
Because I think that's, you know, that's the one of the wonderful things about doing this is that you do get to connect with people, and I think that's kind of what makes people people, is that we share information through stories and art.
Yeah. And isn't the challenge the art, the artistry of storytelling and writing is, I was talking to my wife about this just the other night, she's a writer too and an artist, is leaving, knowing how much room to leave for the reader. Can't tell them everything, but if you don't tell
yeah.
them enough, they won't, but you want to leave enough room that they make the connection in their mind. That's when, boom, it lights up for them. But leaving just enough room for the reader so they see it without you telling them
yeah.
every little thing.
Yeah, and you know, and you don't want to feel like you're talking down to the reader. And,
no.
No, right. But you know, at the same time, you have to realize that because people are so different, when you whatever balance you feel like you're striking, there's going to be somebody who's just not going to
yep.
put it together. And
that's
I've
right.
come across that
that's
too,
right.
where you know, like there's something that I thought was very obvious.
Yep.
I'll give an example. So for book three, which my agent's currently shopping around, that is about this. So a lot of my other work has taken me to a lot of I've done a lot of international travel, and I saw this industry called morology, or it's a professional mourning. It's people that get hired for funerals to cry and weep and make dead people seem that much more memorable, and you see it in a lot of places. Except for, say, Western Europe and the United
right.
States. And
okay.
so my book kind of presupposes that somebody developed a cottage industry in New York City to make rich and loathsome people more likable when they die. And so my main character is the world's, you know, the country's highest paid professional mourner in New York, living in New York City. But the open is I wanted to do something very disruptive in the open. So all you know is basically that he's crashing his own funeral, not he's not being buried, but he's crashing
right.
a funeral he should otherwise be working, and
right.
he's, you know, he may be drunk, he's very unsettled, and he goes to the coffin and he basically urinates on the casket. And that's my opening scene. And
okay.
I thought that was pretty obvious what the significance of that was. And yet, there was one person who said, "Well, what's the significance of somebody urinating on at a funeral?" And I was
wow.
like, "That's kind of universal." I thought.
You thought so, the pissing on the grave, but you know, you don't. You know what it is? It's like a joke. Either you get the joke or you don't. And if the person if they don't get it, they don't get it. And once you explain a joke, it's not funny. And it's the same with your book.
Exactly.
You don't
yeah.
make the connection. There's nothing you can do. You know, you always have to balance that. And so the Euthanist and the Empress of Temper are thrillers. Are you staying in the thriller genre? Is that really your jam?
That's kind of my jam. I think with book four, I'm trying something. I'm adding in a little bit of a supernatural element. But for the most part, you know, the Euthanist is all about the death with dignity movement, and we follow a euthanasia practitioner around. And the second book, The Empress of Temper, is about this kind of blood feud that stirs up in the art industry, and kind of this grisly thriller, but it's all about the art industry in New York and how quirky it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like pushing tension as much as I can. And I think that, you know, inevitably lands you in the thriller genre.
Now, you know, it's always a funny thing. I don't like tension in my own life. I like things to go easy, but I do like to be made tense. Isn't that interesting? You don't want tension in your life, and yet,
no.
you know, we want everything just to go smooth. But
well, that's the thing about thrillers. Is like you're yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, but as writers, I thrive off of misery. I mean, I write, I write nonfiction. I write about my own life, but I'm always looking back on my most unhappy moments, the things where I was most troubled, most struggling the most. That's what I write about.
Yeah, and well, I think that this is something I talk a lot about on my show, where the idea of writing a thriller, you're putting characters into situations that you or I would want to avoid. You know, like
mm-hmm.
anything that happens
mm-hmm.
in a suspense novel is something we would never want to have happen to us. And I think there are a few different reasons why we're compelled by it, and this is my own theory, but I think part of it is that it's a little bit of a cautionary tale to everybody else. You know, I think that reading a book like Silence of the Lambs, I think part of the reason that it resonated with people is it was one of the first times you read about a serial killer in the way that we currently understand how they operate.
Yeah.
And so it was like a cautionary tale that there are people that are unfortunately out there that do things like this.
Sure.
And I think it's also the sense of, if I got put into that kind of situation, what would I do? And in a way, like the characters on the page mirror us, and we want to know, if would we be okay? Would we make it? Would we, it's a way of kind of living through these trials that could really happen, and in a way, putting ourselves into danger to see how we could test our mettle. And that, so I think that that's part of I think what compels us. It's like writing a roller coaster.
I think also there is this element, which is that I think being at peace, feeling safe, feeling content is actually, I know now, that that's actually our natural state of being. However, we don't live there all the time. And to me, it's like breathing. Like being at peace, being content is really as natural as breathing. But when I hold my breath, which is like tension, which is literally what you do when you're tense, oh my God, is he going to be okay? You hold your breath. When you release your breath, that moment of going back to breathing is when you appreciate breathing, when you appreciate again what was normal. And I think sometimes that's the benefit of tension, to appreciate what always was. You forget how wonderful it is. You forget how great a good pair of shoes are until you put on a pair of shoes that don't fit quite right. You forget how good it is to be at peace until you've been tense. And it's that appreciation of it which gives that gift of life kind of back to us, I think. What do you think?
I think it's a really good point, and it reminds me that there's a conversation I was having with a psychologist. I think his name was Doug Lyle, but he was, and there's a writer named Doug Lyle, but it's not the same guy. But he has, he's part of this evolutionary theory of psychology, and part of what that, when he was talking through different emotional states that people find themselves in, the way he modeled it, he basically said, all right, he modeled it all around how we feel depending on our perception of whether we'll succeed at something. And so
right.
if we want to do something and we feel like there's a 0% chance that we're going to actually win or be able to do what we want, then that's depression. And
right.
it kind of goes up from there. And he said that, the real excitement is when you're 75-80% chance, there's a chance that you're pretty sure you're going to do it, but you're not quite sure because you haven't done it yet. That's when we're really excited about something. And he said
right.
when you get to 100% and you know that whatever you want to do, you're going to do, there's no excitement anymore. You just
That's right.
It's completely neutral. It's what you're saying. Like when you're breathing normally, you're completely at peace, but there's no sense of emotional exhilaration because you're just
That's
doing
right.
what you're supposed to do.
That's right.
So I think
That's
part
right.
of it is that, there's – yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, so I think part of it, like based on what you're saying, like this model of how we react in different situations, and it could be that like there are part of us just seek out a thrill and we have to push ourselves outside of being comfortable to feel that.
I think there's an expression called push yourself out of your comfort zone. I have decided that my job is not to push myself out of my comfort zone, but to pursue it. That in truth, my comfort zone keeps moving, and my job is to keep following it and to stay interested and to stay evolving and stay curious, that if I stay doing the same thing, it actually isn't my comfort. I actually become uncomfortable. I need to follow it. And there's always that sense of that mild discomfort that comes from learning, of having to find something new. But my job, I've learned, is to pursue it. Like that Joseph Campbell, great Joseph Campbell quote of follow your bliss, that you keep following your comfort zone, follow your curiosity. Does that make sense?
I think that's really insightful. I like the idea that, and I think that's true, but I haven't ever thought of it like that, of the idea of your comfort zone. It's forever expanding because you are always doing
that's
new
right.
things. So once they stop being new to you, then those boundaries get pushed further out. So you always
that's right.
You're either living inside them or you're testing your boundary even further over time.
That's right.
I think that's an interesting idea.
Well, Alex, you're an interesting guy, and this has been a fabulous conversation. I'm so glad I got you on the show. And I hope when book numbers 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 come out, I can have you back on. But in the meantime, I have one more question for you. And what
yes.
I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you, Alex?
Completely surrender yourself and work as hard as you can, and because I think that your tenacity is rewarded. So I think writing has taught me the value of putting in hard work.
Good. Yeah, it does pay off. It does pay off. The seeds do grow, don't they?
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. They all do. Well, Alex, okay, the book is The Empress of Tempera, available where all fine books are sold?
Correct.
All right. Excellent. Well, best of luck with it and all your others, and I hope we get to chat again.
All right, Bill. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Hard work pays off, people. Hard work. Or just attention. It's like a garden. Alex is absolutely right. I'm taking his words and running with them a little bit, but it's like a garden. You water it, it grows. It grows. It grows. You might not, the seed is under the ground and you're putting the water on. You can't see it, but it is. It is. Just keep watering. Just keep watering, it'll grow. Okay, next week I'll be back with Thomas M. Stirner talking about a book called Fully Engaged, a little self-help book. And then I'm going to take a little time off for the holiday seasons, people. But I'll be back with more author interviews. More fearless writing. And until then, go out there and just do what you love.